You're listening to The Diplomat's podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda, an editor at The Diplomat, and I'm joined today by my colleague Shannon Tiezi, our editor for all things China, and Prashant Parameswaran, our editor focused on Southeast Asia. Thank you, Shannon and Prashant, for joining me today.
Thanks.
And Shannon and Prashant will join me today for a discussion on the recent oral arguments at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, where the Philippines has filed a case to ask that the court rule on the validity of China's nine-dash line as a maritime claim, the status of individual features that China occupies in the South China Sea that are disputed with the Philippines, and Beijing's interference in the Philippines' activities in that area. So notably, and I want to state this very clearly at the beginning of this podcast, what the permanent court cannot do under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea is determine the sovereignty of individual territorial features, which is obviously the central issue in the South China Sea, is who actually owns these features. So that is not up for discussion, but basically we're at the phase right now in these arguments where the court is determining whether it has the right of to actually decide on this case, whether it has the jurisdiction, and that'll be the first step. Now, China has said that it won't participate in this case. It doesn't recognize the validity, and it won't submit to an external arbitration process on these issues. It prefers to approach these bilaterally, but Shannon will talk a little bit to us about China's position, since they have sort of submitted a very odd position paper that's not actually a position paper on this case. So they do have views that have been stated officially, and we'll learn a bit more about that. So Prashant, to start us off, since you're our Southeast Asia expert, do you want to tell us a bit about how the Philippines got here? And obviously, the South China Sea, as our listeners of this podcast will be aware, has been changing quite a bit. China's been pursuing aggressive land reclamation and construction activities there as this case has loomed on the horizon for some time now. So Prashant, do you want to tell us a bit about the Philippines' perspective on these disputes and why they decided to take this to an international court?
Sure. I think it'd be useful to just frame the discussion broadly in terms of, so since 2008, 2009, you've seen a pattern of increasing Chinese assertiveness in the South China Sea, and the Philippines has borne the brunt of that. So the Scarborough Shoal was infamously seized from the Philippines in 2012. Among a number of Chinese actions that constitute, you know, assertiveness by the other Southeast Asian claimants. So the Philippines had decided after a few years of this happening, and realizing also that they have one of the weakest militaries in Asia, that the legal instrument is probably the one that they want to use to bring China to court, essentially, and challenge some of the claims that it's making, primarily the nine-dash line, as you pointed out earlier, but also some of the other maritime claims and some of the features that China is making with respect to them. So they're hoping for some clarity on that. I think the Philippines, since they filed the case last year, as you pointed out, China released a position paper in response, effectively saying that the court's decision. So the court has, as we'll get into later, two phases where they have to discuss things. So the first is sort of the jurisdiction phase, whether they actually have jurisdiction to decide on these claims that the Philippines.
And how serious is the jurisdiction question? Can you tell us a bit about that? You know, is that going to be a serious hurdle for the Philippines, or is that a bit of a fait accompli? I mean, I've kind of seen the former take on that. That'll actually be an open question whether jurisdiction exists here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it will depend a lot on how the courts decide court decides it. So the Chinese have come out with the position paper, which Shannon will talk about later, which basically says that the court clearly has no jurisdiction. I mean, for the Chinese, they very clearly have laid out the fact that you can't really decide these maritime claims that the Philippines is talking about without discussing some of the land claims, because that's where sovereignty comes from. So if the court can't decide on the sovereignty issue, they can't really decide on maritime claims. And China has also claimed secondarily that the Philippines and China have been pursuing all kinds of bilateral negotiations in the past, and China and ASEAN, which the Philippines is a member of, have signed a declaration of the code of conduct, and the Philippines is essentially violating some of these other agreements that they've reached. So the jurisdiction issue for the Chinese is a very clear one, and they released the position paper to say very clearly the court doesn't have it. I think the Philippines has been very careful to avoid the sovereignty issue and focus on the maritime claims, primarily because the fact is that the Arbitral Tribunal at The Hague doesn't really have the mandate to discuss sovereignty issues. They
Right.
can't do that. So the Philippines has been very careful to make sure that they're doing that so that they will win the jurisdiction question. And so far, all indications are that the Filipinos think that they've played this hand very well. They've clearly sort of laid out their case and what the three issues they're looking to are about. And based on that, the jurisdiction issue for them should be pretty straightforward. I think they're more focused on whether they can actually win at least some of these claims, specific claims that they're making. So.
Mm-hmm. And Shannon, can you tell us a bit more about the Chinese position in detail?
Sure. So China, as you guys mentioned, has been very adamant that they are not participating in this case. They're very upset that the Philippines was bringing this case. As Prashant mentioned, they view this as a violation of the 2002 Declaration of Conduct between ASEAN and China. They also view it as in violation of several bilateral agreements between China and the Philippines not to pursue arbitration or legal action until negotiations had been exhausted as a possibility. So China is not participating in this case, and they don't want to legitimize the case by being viewed as participating in it. But at the same time, they don't want the Philippines' legal arguments to go entirely uncontested before the arbitral tribunal. So China's in a little bit of a bind here. And the way they decided to play this was right before the deadline for them officially submitting a memorial to the arbitral tribunal in response to the Philippine case. They publicly, not to the tribunal, but publicly released an official position paper outlining their legal arguments for the case. So in effect, what China is doing is saying, we are not participating in this case. But if we were, here is what our legal arguments would be. And Prashant already went over these a little bit. I'll go over them again quickly. China's main point is that the court has no jurisdiction because it does not have the ability to decide on questions of sovereignty. And as Prashant said, China's argument is you can't address any of these questions the Philippines is raising without getting at the core issue of sovereignty. So that's a jurisdiction question. China has also argued that the arbitration process itself is invalid because China has, first of all, opted out of the possibility of compulsory arbitration under UNCLOS. So they say we are not bound to respect the arbitral process in any event. And regardless, the Philippines is overstepping its bounds in doing this because they're violating these bilateral agreements. Although, of course, the Philippines says we've negotiated with China. It hasn't worked. This is our last resort. China's position is we can still negotiate. And so we are not at a point where we have to do arbitration. And the Philippines is violating agreements with us by pursuing arbitration. And what's interesting is that the court has, in effect, taken this exactly the way China would want, in that even though this wasn't an official memorial to the tribunal, they are seriously considering this position. They asked the Philippines for a supplementary memorial sort of rebutting China's rebuttal on these questions of jurisdiction. They also decided to hold a separate hearing solely on the question of jurisdiction, which was something the Philippines had been hoping to avoid. They wanted the court to hear the arguments on jurisdiction and the actual merits of the case together to sort of streamline the process and prevent this whole thing from being forestalled by the court saying, no, we don't have jurisdiction, sorry. But apparently the tribunal took China's position paper seriously enough that they said, no, we do need to hold a separate hearing on the issue of jurisdiction, and the Philippines has to respond to China's position paper, even though it wasn't actually a formal memorial submitted to the tribunal. As for whether or not they're going to decide in favor of China on these legal arguments, I am not a legal scholar, so I really have no idea. But I think China is having their cake and eating it too. They're clearly, the tribunal is very concerned that they need to have China's voice heard despite the problem of China refusing to participate in the negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, on one level, it seems like China, the posture that China has taken is quite good in a way. I mean, it doesn't look like China is completely eschewing international law in the South China Sea by submitting this position paper that's not even a position paper, just publicly. You know, it shows that at least China is thinking in terms of international law, even if it's not, you know, acting in compliance with it in some ways with its reclamation and construction activities. But also, can we talk a bit about, you know, Shannon, you wrote that article for The Diplomat, I'll include it in the description for this podcast, about how, you know, there's a very serious question in international relations that's been a perennial question is the, you know, whether might makes right. And it seems like, you know, the Philippines is obviously a much smaller country, a much weaker country militarily. China is much larger. It has had it has deployed a massive amount of resources to improve these low tide elevations and rocks in the South China Sea that are disputed, basically elevating them to the status of man-made islands with these facilities on them, helping it bolster its claims. How are these two countries, you know, reading this, and just in terms of, you know, a broader struggle between might and international law? I guess Prashant, do you maybe want to start with that?
Sure. Yeah. So I think it really gets to what I was talking about earlier. So the framing for the Philippines, and they've said this publicly, I think the Philippine Foreign Secretary Alberto Del Rosario, when he was making the Philippine statement at the tribunal, he very clearly said, this is not about the Philippines and China. This is not about our claims versus what the Chinese are doing. This is about international law and whether it matters in international relations. So essentially, it's the scenario that the Philippines is painting is the fact that the Chinese have essentially violated UNCLOS and international law by what they've been doing. So seizing individual features, creating tensions in the South China Sea, extensive land reclamation activities, whatever you want to frame under that. And effectively, weaker nations like the Philippines, which is one of the weakest militaries in Asia, their only recourse where they'll have a fair hearing is in an international court in a case of this nature. So that's how the Philippines is framing it. And I think that's good in the sense that for the Philippines, it actually essentially equalizes the dispute. So you're not dealing with China, which has a far superior military and is able to do these things in the South China Sea that the Philippines is not, at least you'll have a fair hearing in court. But the risk here is that, as you know, as many have expected, China, even if the court decides, as I argued in a piece earlier, I think a few weeks ago, even if the court decides in favor of the Philippines on most of the things that it's claiming, China is most likely going to ignore the decision of the tribunal, which then puts international law in kind of a weird position. If you're arguing that this whole case is a big test of international law and China effectively just ignores it once it happens, that's a big blow for international law and global norms. And so where do we move from here is going to be a key question. So it's an interesting strategy by the Philippines, but I think it also carries a lot of risks.
I mean, there are also costs for China, right, in that scenario. I mean, let's talk a bit about that because I think that's interesting. And I'd love to hear what Shannon has to say. Basically, if China, you know, if this case goes the ways of the Philippines, hypothetically, in an ideal scenario, the Philippines wins all its arguments and China ignores them, continues its activities unabated in the South China Sea, then the whole narrative of, you know, peaceful rise, being a non-revisionist power that's kind of being accommodated into the international system goes a bit out of the window. So I wonder what the contingency then is for Beijing and how it would act in a post, you know, permanent court of arbitration having decided for Philippines scenario. Shannon, what do you think?
I think China is very aware of the risks that are posed by the tribunal ruling against it. As Prashant said, China has no intention of following the tribunal's ruling. It's made that clear since the day the Philippines officially announced that it had filed the case for arbitration. So that's pretty much out at this point. So what China is doing right now is they're trying as hard as they can to counter the Philippines' claim that this is a giant test case for international law writ large. What China is saying is that the Philippines is abusing international law, again, going back to the argument that the court doesn't have jurisdiction and that China is within its legal rights to refuse to participate in this arbitration. They're saying the Philippines is abusing the international legal system for its own selfish ends. Again, China claims almost all of the South China Sea. So they say the Philippines is illegally occupying our features and trying to use international law to illegally occupy more of our features. They've been very adamant that this whole China threat narrative portrayed by the Philippines is completely false, that China has no intention of threatening freedom of navigation or of causing tensions in the South China Sea, which is all stuff that we've heard a million times before. I think the problem for China is that if we're talking about this in the court of public opinion, which I think both countries are trying to win that case as well as the actual tribunal case, the Philippine argument is much more emotionally resonant, right? You have this small country, their only defense for their sovereign rights is international law. They're bringing it to bear and big bully China is ignoring it. Whereas China's argument is very legally technical. They're saying, well, there's all of these legal things that are going on that mean the Philippines doesn't have the right to bring this case. That's not going to resonate very well in the media and in the international community, in the populations of these countries. So it's difficult for China to spin its counter narrative because it's just not as emotionally appealing to people. And that is going to be a problem when China decides to ignore the ruling of the tribunal. There's going to be this massive image problem. But to date, that has not affected China's actions really in any meaningful way in when it comes to the South China Sea and these sovereignty disputes. So we'll see how good China is at ignoring this sort of international approbation. We'll just have to see.
Right. I do want to go over the five core arguments in the case, because I think they're interesting, especially when we're talking about these technical issues regarding jurisdiction. I mean, so UNCLOS doesn't do anything with a territorial sovereignty, which is very clear. But, you know, some of the things that the Philippines is asking the court to declare, simply determine whether the status of certain features in the South China Sea. And that to me seems like it has very little to do with the issue of actual sovereignty. It's basically, saying, here's this feature that is sometimes above the water and sometimes under the water. China has dumped a bunch of sand on it and built a facility on it. Does that change what this feature is? Is this feature a low tide elevation? Is it a rock or is it an island? Because based on which of those three it is, under UNCLOS, it is afforded different rights. And I don't know if it's possible for the Philippines to ask for like a division of the question and consider some of these issues independently, because obviously, things like determining historic rights and the validity of the nine dash line, maybe that gets a bit more into the territorial issues that are sticky under the jurisdiction issue. And again, I'm not a legal scholar, but if anybody's listening that is a legal scholar, please leave a comment answering that question. just which of these arguments do you think the Philippines is likely to get most, most support from the tribunal on? It seems like the issue of the actual status of the features is very uncontroversial, but the historic rights and nine dash line thing seems a little bit stickier.
Go ahead,
Prashant.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the clearest, so Ankit, you laid out sort of, the three central claims very clearly early on in the podcast. So the first is the validity of the nine dash line. And then the second is the nature and the nature of the legal entitlements, right? And the effects of individual features that China's occupying, whether it's low tide elevations, islands, et cetera, et cetera. And then the third is China's interference, what the Philippines views as China's interference of its activities in the so-called, West Philippine Sea, right? So whether it's fisheries, petroleum exploration, et cetera, et cetera. I think within those three categories, I would say the first one, which is the nine dash line, is probably the one that's going to get, I would say, the most likely for the Philippines to win, because I think it's quite clear that China's nine dash line is not consistent with international law and with UNCLOS. I think when you get into some of these individual features, it gets extremely difficult because you're getting more into the weeds, right? So whether you're going to classify something as rocks or low tide elevations or islands, which you said, these seem like very granular issues that we shouldn't think about, but they actually are immensely important because they determine how much of a distance you have for your features, right? So whether you're entitled to 12 nautical miles of territorial seas or more, when you have an EEZ or a continental shelf, that's extremely important. But I think it's less clear on those questions. And I think the third question is even less clear when you get into the extent to which China is interfering with Philippine resource use activities in the West Philippine Sea, because essentially that is tied to the previous question, right? So if that these features are interpreted to be within China's territory as opposed to the Philippines' territory, then that would affect what China can do or cannot do to the Philippines and vice versa. But I think the first issue, which is the nine-dash line, appears a little bit more straightforward just because it's a lot more vague, right? So when you get into the specifics and the weeds of any of these questions, you get into a lot of legal technicalities. So.
Yeah, I mean, the nine-dash line has been left very ambiguous by China, you know, whether it represents the maximum extent of claims or the claims to actual land features within that area. It's they've kind of left it an open question. So if the court does rule against it, you know, China will have the opportunity to have a face-saving explanation of the nine-dash line, which they've never really done.
And that's actually a really excellent point, because I think the argument that some people have been making is that the Chinese, even though they have declared the nine-dash line, it's extremely vague, as you pointed out, and that at some point China does recognize that it may have to clarify the extent of the nine-dash line. And in effect, perhaps the court ruling, China may not say that it's doing it because of the court's ruling, but sometime in the future, China may clarify the extent of the nine-dash line on its own accord. And so that's something that we should watch for, because the main thing with the nine-dash line has been, as you said, its vague nature.
I don't know, Shannon, what do you think about that? Is that on the cards?
I think China is wrestling with this question of how to go about clarifying the nine-dash line, because there's a pretty clear consensus among scholars that it would be ideal to do so, because the international community is so adamant that what is this nine-dash line? It needs to be clarified. We don't know what it is. The problem is China can't figure out a way to clarify the nine-dash line without making it obvious that it is in violation of UNCLOS. And China has previously said, well, the nine-dash line predates UNCLOS, so we don't have to worry about it. That's not very convincing to the international community. So the problem for China is, how can we clarify this nine-dash line in a way that meshes with internationally respected maritime rights and yet doesn't give up parts of the territories that are included in the nine-dash line? We don't give up any of these claims that we've been clinging to since the 1940s. And they haven't figured out a way to do that. And I think that's why we haven't seen any clarity on this. Now, it is very possible, should the tribunal rule against the nine-dash line, that China will then immediately come out and say, oh, they misinterpreted the line. That's not what it means. This is what it means. But I don't know if we're going to get the sort of clarity that people are really looking for, which is like the actual longitude and latitude physical coordinates for the line, because right now it's just kind of like someone took a Sharpie and drew on a map and we're like, yeah, that's about it. You know, there's no real clarity of when are you within the nine-dash line and where are you without it. What we might see is a bit more clarity on, within this nebulous, indefined line, what exactly is China claiming? Is it the land features within that? Is it some sort of weird hybrid EEZ maritime rights nine-dash line thing where China has the rights to fishery resources and oil, gas resources as well? That issue, I think, is going to be clarified first, has a better chance of being clarified than the actual geographic dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both for joining me today and providing your expertise as usual. For listeners, we'll be covering the South China Sea as regular at The Diplomat. We have a few pieces coming up actually from a few writers who are experts on this issue of arbitration and the legal issues in the South China Sea. So keep an eye out for those. Shannon, Prashant, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Sankit.
And if you like this podcast, remember to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes and subscribe to our future episodes. Thank you very much for listening.